My intellectual life is largely divided between two individuals. For those of you who know my work, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X lay claim to most of my time over the last 25 years. I wrote a short political biography of Du Bois back in 86. It was revised and it came out again last year. I have written primarily of political studies of intellectuals and activists in the making of American history, challenging structures of racialized inequality. Last year, with Merle Evers Williams, I published the autobiography of Megger Evers, which is not really an autobiography. It's really a collection of his speeches and writings and a reconstruction of his life, because for the very simple reason that of the three iconic figures who sacrificed their lives in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Medgar Evers, only Medgar had not a single book documenting his speeches and writings. I thought it was about time to give Medgar a book. So there is much we have to do in the terrain of African-American history in this country. Most Americans under the age of 40 have read the autobiography of Malcolm X. Many Americans, millions, have seen Spike Lee's interpretation of Malcolm X in the 3-hour and 5-minute film that came out in 1992. Some colleagues have asked me, doesn't Malcolm X already have a biography? And I have to even correct my colleagues in the history department. There is a difference between an autobiography and a biography. So this is a biography of Malcolm X. And the reason that there has not been a historian's biography of such a central figure in the 20th century as Malcolm is because the archival evidence relating to Malcolm has been suppressed, in part by the United States government. Even to this day, 27,000 pages of FBI documents remain unavailable to scholars, although 22,000 pages are now open. We have the archival evidence from the City of New York's archival office, the forensic evidence that was collected by the DA, the district attorney, that's available. The difficulty in reconstructing Malcolm's life is that Malcolm was constantly involved in the art of reinventing himself and in manufacturing narratives, metaphors, not unlike St. Augustine's Confessions, to reveal to those he sought to transform, that he himself had been degraded, had been a criminal, an outcast. And at first, through the divine intervention of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, raised from literally the grave, which was the original purpose of the book. Then, as Malcolm's politics and his vision of faith shifted and radically changed, the purpose of the autobiography changed. The dilemma is, for the historian, is that there are certain lacuna that are embedded in a text, in part from fragments taken from it. So during the process of writing the biography, I learned that 3 chapters in the autobiography were stripped from the book prior to publication. Keep in mind, Malcolm was assassinated in February 1965. The book appears in November 65. Also keep in mind, there are 2 authors of the autobiography, Malcolm X and journalist Alex Haley. How much of Malcolm is in the autobiography? And then finally, there is a problem of the memory and the man, that Malcolm has become an iconic figure to millions of African Americans and people of African descent, and more generally, to 1 billion Muslims throughout the world. The first postage stamp celebrating Malcolm X was issued not by the United States government in 1998, but by the government of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran in 1983. Malcolm is a charismatic, iconic figure to the world's Muslims. One student put it to me this way in a seminar at Columbia University when I inquired, what is the difference between Dr. King and Malcolm X? He explained, Dr. Marable, don't you understand? Martin Luther King Jr. belongs to the entire world, but Malcolm X belongs to us. There is an intensity of ownership in this man. And the difficulty for the historian is that our task is not to make icons or to topple them, but to reveal the humanity behind the image that we want to turn into a kind of a stone portrait. Malcolm was an extraordinary figure, but made disastrous mistakes, as all of us do. But by revealing his humanity, we find his true greatness. And that's what I seek to do. I am reading today a chunk of a chapter entitled The Legend of Detroit Red. Now, some of you probably have not read the autobiography. Let me just refresh your memory. In the autobiography of Malcolm X, about a third of the book focuses on Malcolm in Harlem in the 1940s. And both Haley and, later, Spike Lee, and millions of Americans, including the hip-hop generation of the 1990s to the present, from Tupac Shakur to Dead Prez to you name it, they've incorporated this myth that Malcolm X, when he was in his teens, was a notorious gangster called Detroit Red. Detroit Red was a criminal, he was a trickster, he manipulated things, and so this dynamic, he was a celebrant of physical culture, he was an award-winning dancer on the floor of the grand ballroom of the Savoy doing the Lindy Hop, backed up by Chick Webb's orchestra or Benny Goodman. That's the way the legend goes. What I'm arguing today is that this is largely fictive. I know I can hear some gasps. So the book has to try to explain, why did Malcolm construct this character? And why do we believe the character is true? According to the autobiography of Malcolm X, between the years 1941 to 1945, a Negro teenager named Malcolm Little was transformed into a notorious urban outlaw, Detroit Red. The metamorphosis took place mostly in the hard scrabble, mean streets of Harlem during World War II. The zoot suit donned, Lindy-hopping, gun-toting Detroit Red was a sophisticated, consummate hustler peddling marijuana to jazz musicians at clubs and to street clients, burglarizing homes in the suburbs, working as a steerer for whites to buy sexual services in Harlem, and running numbers for criminal gangs. This vivid gangster character presented in the autobiography was so powerful and persuasive that Spike Lee's 1991 Hollywood film biography of the subject devoted nearly a full hour, one-third of the entire flick, to the Detroit Red phase of Malcolm's life. In the 1990s, as gangster rap and hip-hop music and culture proliferated, artists such as Ice Cube to Tupac Shakur constantly sampled Malcolm X. Some incorporated the images of Detroit Red, the hip ghetto outlaw, into their artistic productions. Few ask whether this legendary black urban outlaw was more fictive than reality. The enduring fascination with the legend of Detroit Red is because it is simultaneously a coming-of-age narrative in which an unsophisticated boy from largely rural America learns the various private and public performances of black masculinity during the turbulent era of World War II. Earl Little Sr. had embodied, Malcolm's father, had embodied the primary model of black manhood that young Malcolm had known. Fiercely independent, proud, hardworking, a devoted public advocate of black pride and power, as well as a stern husband who could display private fits of anger and violence towards his wife and children. As Maria Josefina Saldana Portillo has observed, Earl Little's death denied Malcolm, quote, a literal and figurative relationship to the patrimonic. The murder of Earl Little at the hands of a contemporary white racist mob severs Malcolm Little from his father, symbolically replicating the racist violence of slavery, which severs an entire race from its ancestry, unquote. Without renouncing the iconic memories of his beloved father, young Malcolm sought to create a masculinist adult identity for himself, drawing upon the cultural and social elements that were made available to him in the urban jazz era cultures of Roxbury in Boston and Harlem in New York City. Although Malcolm X himself and subsequent scholars would describe these years as a destructive detour in a life of political engagement and spiritual revelation, the myth of Detroit Red would provide an essential and enduring dimension of what the later man would become. America's formal entry into World War II on December the 9th, 1941, prompted several million white males to volunteer for services in the armed forces. Harlem had a long history of sending its sons into war in defense of American democracy. The Harlem Hellfighters, the all-black 369th U.S. Infantry, had fought with great courage with the French army at the Western Front during World War I. Indeed, the first Croix de Guerre decoration on any U.S. military had been given to Private Nedham Roberts and Corporal Henry Lincoln Johnson, both of the 369th. During World War II, the 369th would participate in combat in Okinawa in 1945. The majority of African Americans were overwhelmingly patriotic, yet a substantial percentage of blacks were uncertain about their participation in what they viewed as another white man's war. The U.S. military remained, of course, racially segregated, despite the 1940-41 mobilization of black socialist leader A. Philip Randolph's Negro March on Washington movement that had successfully pressured the administration of Franklin Roosevelt to sign Executive Order 8802, outlawing racial discrimination in hiring in defense factories in July 1941. The war's immediate impact, however, was that hundreds of thousands of white men's jobs became vacant nearly overnight. Now, many employers had no recourse except to hire Negroes and women to fill these positions. In critical industries such as railroads, which in the 40s were the principal means of national transportation, the demand for workers became terribly acute. It wasn't difficult for young Malcolm Little, despite his short and abysmal employment record, to secure employment on the New York to Boston Yankee Clipper as a, quote, fourth class cook, unquote. Quote, fourth cook, I knew, was just a glorified name for dishwasher, Malcolm recognized. Quote, but it wouldn't be my first time, and just as long as I traveled where I wanted, it didn't make any difference to me. Temporarily, though, they put me on the colonial that ran to Washington, D.C., unquote. The greatest benefit derived from the Yankee Clipper job was Malcolm's direct access to the fabled black Mecca of his childhood, Harlem. Louise and Earl Sr. Little long ago had regaled their children with stories, with fables of Harlem's legendary black institutions, its broad, shining boulevards, its vibrant cultural and political life. Yet nothing, not even Roxbury's excitement, had fully prepared the black teenager for his first encounter with the neighborhood with which he would one day be indelibly linked. Quote, "New York was heaven to me, and Harlem, seventh heaven," Malcolm exclaimed in his autobiography years later. His first stop on the was the popular bar nightclub, Small's Paradise. Quote, "No Negro place of business had ever impressed me so much. Around the big, luxurious-looking circular bar were 30 or 40 Negroes, mostly men, drinking and talking. Like a frantic tourist, Malcolm went quickly from sight to celebrated sight. He stood admiringly before the Apollo Theater and walked east on 125th Street. Quote, "I saw the big, tall, gray Hotel Teresa. It was the finest in New York City, where Negroes could then stay, years before the downtown hotels would accept the black man," unquote. That evening, Malcolm made what would be a fateful decision, quote, "I had left Boston and Roxbury forever," unquote. According to the autobiography, Malcolm soon hung around Small's and the bar at the Braddock Hotel on West 126th Street, a hangout for the Apollo's entertainers, quote, "so much that the bartenders began to pour a shot of bourbon, my favorite brand of it anyway, when they saw me walk through the door. My friends now included musicians like Duke Ellington's great drummer, Sonny Greer, and the great personality with the violin, Ray Nance," unquote. Malcolm had constructed two radically different personas for himself. At work, back on the Yankee Clipper, he continued to excel as, quote unquote, "sandwich red," entertaining white patrons as they purchased his sandwiches. He had a big sandwich thing, right? But in Harlem, he was acquiring a growing circle of friends in the hustler subculture and among jazz musicians as young Red, a wild, cocky kid from Michigan who was quickly learning the language of the streets. Malcolm began supplementing his income by peddling marijuana, casually at first, then more aggressively. Bea Corrigan, his girlfriend from Boston, frequently came down from Boston to visit her lover, and Malcolm proudly paraded her at his favorite bars and night spots in Harlem's after-hours joints. For a man-child who, on May 17, 1942, had only reached his 17th birthday, Malcolm Little's successful reinvention of himself was nothing short of remarkable. The autobiography's narrative gives the deliberate impression that Little's personal commitment to legitimate employment existed largely in the period 1941-42, and that from 1943 until his arrest by Boston police in January 1946, he was primarily devoted to illegal and increasingly violent criminal activities. This is undoubtedly the reason that Malcolm dates his employment at Harlem's popular Small's Paradise beginning sometime in mid-1942, just after he had turned 17 years old, and terminating in early 1943 when he had asked an undercover military detective posing as a Small's patron, quote, if he wanted a woman, unquote, prompting his arrest for solicitation and firing. Since Malcolm Little was in Lansing, Michigan, however, in early 1943, either Malcolm's memory is simply faulty or something else is at work here. A thorough reconstruction of Malcolm Little's work history, his entire work history prior to going to prison, combined with testimonials and oral history accounts from friends who knew him during these years, tells a different tale. Malcolm later claimed that he was, quote, barred from Small's in early 43, and that his amateurish mistake had perhaps placed him under the surveillance of the NYPD. Malcolm's initial employment at Smalls actually began in late March 1943, and it was terminated less than 2 months later, in May 43, when he was briefly detained for solicitation by the plainclothes police detective. He worked periodically, however, between 1942 and 1944, mostly at Jimmy's Chicken Shack restaurant, which is barely mentioned in the book. This is his primary place of employment. Malcolm asserted that he once, well, was briefly employed at Jimmy's as a waiter. But Malcolm's close friend, Clarence Atkins, who first met Red at the restaurant, recalls, quote, "He was flunking for Jimmy, doing anything like washing dishes, mopping floors, or whatever, because he could eat, and Jimmy had a place upstairs, over the place where he could sleep," unquote. One of Jimmy's employers in 43 was the hilarious dishwasher, John Leroy Sanford, who had aspirations for a career in entertainment as a comedian. This was a dishwasher who was hilarious, who told jokes. Both Malcolm and Sanford had red hair. To distinguish the two, Sanford was called Chicago Red, referring to his original hometown. And since no one had ever heard of Lansing, Michigan, Malcolm was eager to claim the title Detroit Red. Sanford, many years later, would become known to millions of Americans as Red Fox, or in the 70s, as Sanford and Son on television. The autobiography's Detroit Red presents a young black man almost completely disinterested, even alienated from politics. Yet Atkins recalls that at Jimmy's Chicken Shack, Malcolm had spoken frequently about black nationalist ideas and militancy. Quote, "He would talk often about how his father used to get brutalized and beat up on the corner selling Marcus Garvey's paper, and he would talk a lot about Garvey's concepts in terms of how they could benefit us as a people," unquote. Embedded throughout the autobiography are fragmentary elements of Malcolm Little's evolving early political and social consciousness during the Harlem years. Even in Malcolm's description of his first foray into Harlem, he briefly mentions the presence of communist organizers in the community. Malcolm writes, quote, "Negro and white canvassers sided up alongside you, talking fast, as they tried to get you to buy a copy of the Daily Worker. This paper's trying to keep your rent controlled, make that greedy landlord kill them rats in your apartment. Who do you think fought the hardest to free the Scottsboro boys?" It would have been literally impossible for Malcolm Little to have lived and worked in Harlem during the Second World War and not to have been directly and profoundly impacted and affected by the community's recent history of intense political struggle. It would have been impossible. By any standard, Harlem in 1940 was the most cosmopolitan and complex center for black political activity and debate, not just in black America, but throughout the African diaspora. I mean, for the Caribbean, Africa, and black America, without any question. Roughly one quarter of Harlem's black population consisted of West Indian immigrants, primarily from Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, British Guyana, and other British colonies, nearly all of whom had established very elaborate political associations, parties, and political clubs of every kind. One of Harlem's most influential West Indian politicians, Hulin Jack, originally from St. Lucia, had been elected in 1940 as a Democrat to represent the neighborhood in the New York State Assembly. Harlem was also the national center of black labor activism for the entire country, headed, of course, by A. Philip Randolph, who had begun his career in Harlem as a Harlem Street orator on 135th Street, even before Garvey's arrival to the United States in 1916. Thousands of Harlem residents were active members of the Communist Party. Harlemite communists Claudia Jones, Benjamin Javis Jr. were widely respected and popular leaders in the neighborhood. Despite the demise of the Garvey movement, Harlem's political agitation and militancy had grown more intense, chiefly around economic issues during the Depression-era 30s. In Harlem, Negro workers in public laundries routinely earned $3 per week less in wages than whites performing identical labor. Employment discrimination was rampant. One 1927-28 survey of 258 Harlem businesses employing over 2,000 workers found that only 163 employees were black, and every one of them in low-wage jobs. As the Great Depression deepened, black joblessness soared in Harlem. Black youth unemployment was estimated in the 30s well above 50%. In 1935, the federal government's Works Progress Administration, the WPA, which had determined the cost of living for maintaining a New York City household at maintenance level was $1,400 annually, estimated the average black family's total income in the city was $1,025. The unequal economics of race and class served to mobilize Harlem's black community. In 1931, the Harlem White Housewives League initiated a campaign at Harlem's chain stores, demanding that they hire more African Americans. Garveyites and black businessmen alike joined the new movement, urging Negroes to support a buy black effort. In 1932, the Harlem Labor Union was created, which quickly attracted many black nationalist and unemployed West Indians. The union picketed whites-owned stores that refused to hire Negroes. In 1933, the Citizens League for Fair Play was established, a popular front of over 40 organizations, including Negro women's groups, religious and fraternal organizations, demanding greater black employment in Harlem's businesses. By 1934, such organizing efforts had culminated in mass public meetings and widespread picket lines. In March 35, the protests sparked a riot in Harlem along 125th Street, involving several thousand people. Dozens of white-owned stores were looted, 627 windows were smashed, 57 civilians, and 7 police officers sustained injuries. Police arrested 75 people, mostly Negroes, on charges ranging from inciting to riot, felonious assault, malicious mischief, and burglary. The NYPD's suppression of the rioters and its subsequent actions in the upheaval's aftermath were subsequently documented by liberal Republican fusion mayor Fiorello LaGuardia's Commission on Conditions in Harlem. Police made, quote, according to the report, quote, derogatory and threatening remarks. One officer shot and killed one young black man who was running without warning. Another policeman, quote, called to arrest an unarmed drunk, hit the drunk so hard that he died. Cops illegally carried out frisks of pedestrians and rioters, searching for, quote unquote, numbers or policy slips to bust up Harlem's underground numbers racket.